Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Everyone, I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. For those of you who are not familiar with this program, we try to improve the quality of our lives. In a time when there's so many confusing issues because we don't know who to believe. We don't even know what to believe. We were told to eat the basic four food groups, to do everything in moderation. We did, and we got sick. We were told, well, it really wasn't your fault. It's not the meat, it's not the dairy, it's not the sugar, it's not the pesticides, it's not the electromagnetic pulses, it's not the unnecessary or excessive x-rays. It's not the irradiation of our food or the genetic engineering of our corn and milk. No, it's genes and sunshine and cigarette smoking. And you think, well, my genes are fine. I don't smoke and I'm not out in the sun. Why am I sick? And they say, well, idiopathic of unknown origin. And we think, okay. And then we tune on this program and we see that we're not quite as lacking in knowledge of cause and effect is what some of the authorities either are or in their own disingenuous way trying to make us believe that we should all be so simple-minded. Now, we know what causes illness, and we know how to prevent it, and we also have ideas of some of the natural, non-toxic ways. There's the rub, because we can't have two winners. We've got one winner. We've got one winner of the Super Bowl. One winner to a presidential election, though this last one kind of contradicted that notion. We have no place for second opinions if the second opinion is from a different belief system. We have our main culture, which all thoughts originate from. We have a subculture that it tolerates the main culture, and the main culture will tolerate the subculture because it's still, for all intents and purposes, the same belief system, just a little different ways of exercising the liberties to do it. And then we have the alternative culture. The alternative culture is a counterculture. Once you're in that counterculture, you have no respect, you get no funding, you're looked upon as if something's wrong with you. And sometimes you actually begin to believe that something's wrong with you. How long did we criticize people for wanting to be healthy? We called them health nuts. They weren't calling anyone else sick nuts, but we made sure we made everyone feel bad about not drinking, not smoking, not eating hamburgers, being a normal weight, unnatural, un-American, not wanting to go out there and get into a testosterone match with someone. That's just unconscionable. So making right choices has not always been supported and rewarded. Person today called me. I'm not in New York or Washington or Los Angeles. I'm traveling, finishing up a documentary, a new program. And this man, who's a friend, said that he had had a checkup at my suggestion because he thought he was well. And the doctor said, no, you've got about 90% occlusion here. You've got a very serious situation, and you may have to have coronary bypass operation. Scared him. He thought at 50, very successful, very wealthy. Quote, Gary, I've got more money than I can spend. Of course, he could give it to the non-commercial radio stations. For some reason, I've never met a Democrat who, or a liberal, is willing to part with their money to a non-commercial cause like this. Staying overnight in the Clinton White House, no amount the checkbook can't be written for. But boy, supporting PFW, KPFK, BAI, they just can't seem to bring themselves to do it. So we struggle. Anyhow, still a friend. And he's been under this impression for a long time that he's well because he had no overt signs of disease. But I know he doesn't deal with stress very well. He holds it in. He's a very quiet person. He holds all of his anxiety and energy and represses it. And now he is having to take a look at everything else that he never did. He's not taking a look at his stock accounts today. He's taking a look at angiograms. And he's saying, whoa. I mean, my first symptom that I was sick might have been my last, a heart attack or stroke. And I said, that's right. He said, you know, Gary, what you've been talking about all these years, he said, I'd listen to you, you know, and do just the opposite. And I realized I was just being defiant. I was just trying to prove to myself that I wouldn't succumb to being a health nut. I said, knowing you're about to be a dead nut. So what's the point of defiance if what it leads to is self-destruction? There's being a rebel with a cause and a rebel without a cause. Better to be one with a cause. So now, at least today, he has a cause, getting himself healthy. And now he's not going to compromise and go back to his comfort foods and addictive behavior. Now he says, and time will tell, that he realizes that he had taken his health for granted, had not committed himself to real change. He's a friend. I gave him a protocol. I'll be there to help him. And the probability is if he sticks with this, he'll be able to get through this and deocclude his arteries. It's happened many, many times before. But he can't keep doing the things he did and expect to live a long and healthy life. More people will die of heart disease this year than anything else. And yet, as a society, we have done very little to wake up to what we have to do. And yet, we look at our doctors, they're dying at a higher rate than the rest of the population. More suicide than any other group in the United States. Your doctor. More drug addiction as a profession than any other group. Now, it doesn't mean they're bad people. That's not what I'm implying. It means they can be just as confused about the issues of life and less able to handle them than you or I. So there is no great gilded place where wise men and women sit and issue down from Olympus all the messages of life that allow us to go unfettered on our way. There's confusion everywhere. The difference is that if you're in a position of power within the mainstream culture, your confusion is almost always denied or hidden. Instead, you give forth certainties. Certainties that diet have no relationship in disease. Certainty exercise won't make a difference in disease. Certainty that meditation has nothing to do with disease. Certainty that prayer has nothing to do with disease. Certainty that pesticides have nothing to do with disease. Certainty that, and suddenly you get all these certainties and you think, well, gee whiz. If you're that certain, then you can't have doubt. Without doubt, there's no reason to question anything else. Without doubt or questioning, how can we grow? What is stays the same, and if what is wrong, then wrong stays forever. And that's why people frequently, more often than not by accident, come across a dial and they think, now that's something I haven't heard before. That's what this program is about, sharing insights that you haven't heard before. Or maybe when you did, you weren't really ready to make the changes. See, we have to go through steps. Just being at the door of change takes a lot of courage. Knocking on it is courage. When it's open, walking through it is courage. Surrendering your need to keep looking over your shoulder to see if what you're doing is right and getting approval from others is courage. It's not done in one fell gestalt, not one serendipitous moment. It just doesn't, you don't go from all negative thoughts and bad living to all good thoughts and positive living. It doesn't happen. It's like a tug of war. And on different days, you're on different sides of the tug, pulling against your own reason and logic. And one day, you're finally through there and you see, whoa, why was I resisting making some positive choices? Is there something so bad about thinking good thoughts that I should have rebelled against it all this time? And then you start realizing the game that we have been playing and who's played it with us and how we lose and they win. So today we're going to do it a little differently. Today we're going to take you on a journey that everyone in this audience will appreciate. It's a very comprehensive journey. I like to use this airways more as a classroom on the air. I let my guests do more talking than any other radio show in the United States. And there's a reason for that. Because if you invited someone on, you've taken the time to really screen all the people out there who have something to say, and they've done their homework, they've proven they deserved a forum, and you give them that forum, then let them really bring forth their arguments. I'm listening like you're listening, and if I see that there's a need for an interjection or a challenge or question, that's the only time I'm going to intercede. Otherwise, this person is going to give you more of a lecture than a discussion. Today, cardiovascular health natural approaches. We're talking about high blood pressure, congestive heart failure, angina, elevated cholesterol, high triglycerides, stroke. We're talking 100 million Americans. Now, we only have about 280 million Americans. So that means that virtually everyone in this audience knows someone who will benefit from this information. And on a purely spiritual level, I believe that we have a spiritual responsibility to share what we know that we believe might be a benefit to someone else, allowing them to make more informed choices. So if you're an ideally healthy person and you've had your checkup, unlike my friend, and you are good in your cardiovascular and your biochemistry, good for you. You didn't do it by accident. You worked on it, and you know the commitment you made, and I'm sure you want to see other people get well at the same time, so share it with someone else. The time will come when the information today will be a blessing, possibly even a lifesaver to someone else. My guest is Dr. Michael Wald. He is a supervisor of nutrition at three complementary medical centers, Advanced Medicine in Mount Kisco, Putnam Preventive Medicine, and Office of Complementary Medicine. He is the author of Hope for Hepatitis. He's a professor of laboratory assessment at University of Bridgeport. Nice to have you back with us today, Michael.
It's very nice to be here, Gary.
Now, Michael, are you on a cell phone, a portable phone, a cordless phone, or a regular phone?
I am on a regular phone.
Good. Good, because we want a good, clear signal from you. Michael, heart disease is the nation's number one killer. Each year, the severity and incidence of heart disease has been steadily increasing. Despite early detection of heart conditions and drugs that commonly treat those conditions, cardiovascular disease still continues to kill millions of Americans. Much of medicine still doesn't utilize safe, non-invasive assessment tools and natural treatments that are available. However, there are many proven natural therapies for detection, prevention, and treatment of cardiovascular disease. I want you to go through these one at a time. Then I want you to go through everything from peripheral vascular disease, arrhythmias, cardiomyopathy, congestive heart failure, hypertension, atherosclerosis, arteriosclerosis, angina. And I want you to talk about the natural therapy specific to each one of these for both prevention and treatment. Is that enough for you?
It sounds great. And you want me to do it in 10 minutes or less, right?
I'm going to give you plenty of time today, Michael. We're not going to rush this. And we've got about 46 minutes in this program left, so we've got time to get into this. All right.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And like you said, I think without a doubt, heart disease is the major killer of the 20th century. Hardening of the arteries, otherwise known as arterial sclerosis, is a thickening and clogging of arteries. And a virtually unknown, Gary, in the 1900s, heart disease is now rampant, as many of us now know in Western cultures. Everyone knows multiple people with heart disease. It's not this rare thing anymore. And today, cardiovascular disease, a term which includes many of the things that you had spoke about, coronary artery vessel disease, congestive heart failure, arrhythmias, stroke. We'll speak about all of those things. Those are you might consider them subtitles under cardiovascular disease, for those of you that are unfamiliar. And for those of you who are listening that think that this doesn't apply to you, you yourself may not have problems. Listen good for other people at the very least, because you will know more than one person that will benefit from this information. So medical therapies, in my opinion, have proven themselves a miserable failure for, as you said, the 100 million or so Americans suffering from cardiovascular disease in the United States. So I think that if it's no wonder that sufferers who are wishing to avoid heart disease, they must actively modify their lifestyles to do so. Otherwise, as your friend did, who was fairly defiant and found out that this, you don't just wake up one day with major vessels blocked. There is a 10, 20, 30-year progression, or what's known as a latency period, for these things to happen. And there have been studies, Gary, that show that even the average 10-year-old has some amount of blockages in coronary vessels. That is amazing. And that was from the New England Journal of Medicine. So there's no doubt that, in my opinion, again, that alternative therapies, or what we call holistic or complementary therapies, provide a variety of non-toxic solutions for both the prevention and the treatment of all of these different types of cardiovascular problems. And, you know, from a common sense point of view, considering that heart disease is not ever caused by any single factor, really necessitates a holistic approach. Again, looking at stress in one's life, looking at pollution, looking at what one puts in their mouths, looking at the state of stress that individual is living in as they're doing all of these things. And yes, genetics has some factor as well in meeting our nutritional genetic needs, looking at as many of these factors as possible so that we can prevent the occurrence of these things for the purpose of not so much living longer, although that's great, but living longer during the disability stage of life. That's where there's we are active and physically vigorous, and that, I think, is very important. We have many patients, and Gary, you've seen them yourself, they are advanced in age, and they are patting themselves on their back for living long. Meanwhile, they're in the office because they have 7 or 8 different diagnoses of different conditions, which we know these different labels we place on them lose sight of the fact that fundamentally there are things wrong with our foods and our stress and our healing processes. And depending on where those weaknesses show up, it might show up as a stroke or it might show up as a migraine. We have different names. Fundamentally, though, foods and nutrients, stress reduction, exercise are key factors. So let me start again by just giving a quick description of the several different types of, to break it down for the purpose of this conversation, of cardiovascular conditions. So most of us are familiar with coronary artery disease. And the coronary arteries are vessels that are, of course, at the heart. And this disease really is a decreased blood flow to the heart, caused commonly by either blockage or hardening or arterial sclerosis of the arteries. And also, of course, fatty deposits, like cholesterol deposits. And we'll speak about very soon how cholesterol has been misinterpreted as the cause of heart disease rather than a result of other factors. And really, it represents a healing process, but too much of a good thing without handling underlying causes gets us in trouble. Medicine, of course, is focused solely, almost solely, on lowering cholesterol without even paying attention to these other factors. And then we have what's known as arrhythmias, or just abnormal heart rhythms. Sometimes the heartbeat is very slow, and sometimes it's very quick, or sometimes it's irregular, what's called a dysrhythmia. So many, many people experience this. And then, of course, there's stroke, which results from lack of blood flow and oxygen to brain tissues, which causes death of brain tissue, and it can be extremely, extremely sudden. Chest pain is a common symptom that some people experience when they have a heart attack. Women usually suffer from fewer symptoms and more fatal heart attacks. Men tend to hang around a while. They suffer, they survive, and suffer through a myriad of symptoms generally, not always, of course. So there are particular things I think that women need to pay attention to, because for some set of unknown reasons, when they get heart attacks, they're often deadly. And high blood pressure or hypertension. And that's often caused by hardening of the arteries. At least this is a physiologic cause. Obviously, chronic stress in one's life can increase your blood pressure. And over a lifetime of chronic stress, your body just loses control and it's chronically high. This increases one's chance of stroke and many, many other problems in the body, like kidney degeneration and kidney disease. And then there's what's known as rheumatic heart disease, not as common, but an infection which causes heart tissue disease. And, you know, a recent study, too, Gary, which just illuminated what we've known of for, I think, at least 20 years, that bacterial infections in the mouth, commonly caused by dental work, are a leading cause or a major cause of cardiovascular disease. Now, we've mostly paid attention to that in terms of if someone had a mitral valve prolapse, which is considered a benign problem in one of the heart valves, that they would have to take tons of antibiotics before they get dental work. Why? Because bacterial problems in the mouth somehow get to the heart. We acknowledged in that situation how bacteria somehow gets in the bloodstream from the mouth and could cause problems with severe heart problems. But we forget the rest of the population that has all sorts of dental work done and chronic infections in their root canals and that type of thing, not to mention the metals, causing and perpetuating heart disease from a bacterial point of view. So it's a very, very interesting thing, but something that is now being looked at even by the mainstream people. It's that predominant. So why don't I start to speak about some of the dietary factors in terms of treatment of heart disease and also avoidance of heart disease. And I'll skim through some of them because I hope they can, they're really considered kind of common sense. I mean, we want to avoid obesity, of course, and overweight in general. Now, many people may not be overweight, but they could be over fat. So that means that relative to their muscle, their water, and their fat balance, they've got too much fat and not enough lean body tissue. And that increases one's risk of virtually any disease. A body composition is a very nice assessment for someone to get because it's actually one of the best predictors of disease. It's also what we call a biomarker. It helps predict how well we're going to age. There are many other markers, of course, but that's a key one. So for someone who is thin and is saying, I won't have a problem with heart disease, meanwhile, they may have it in the family history, pay attention to that. It may not have skipped over you. And not everything is necessarily obvious based on how one appears. You know, there are many very heavy people that don't get heart disease. So we want to look sometimes at blood chemistry as well, which we'll speak about in detail. So everyone has heard about salt, of course, so minimize your salt intake. And, you know, this is somewhat important, but the studies show, Gary, that only about 10% of the population is salt sensitive, meaning that it actually has any bearing on their blood pressure. Now, I'm not saying consume iodized salt products. I think that's terrible. I think we should be consuming, you know, natural forms like kelp granules if we need to salten up things. But the many people are actually sensitive to the chloride. It's not actually the sodium. It's the chloride, which can, in fact, raise blood pressure. Now, another thing to help in general is to consume a high potassium diet, which is easy to do when you're consuming lots of freshly juiced vegetables and fruits, which, again, provide this very bioavailable, easily absorbable form of potassium, along with a myriad of other synergistic minerals and enzymes and fiber and vitamins and other what we call phytochemicals or plant chemicals, which are very important, not just for cardiovascular health, but all degenerative conditions. So as a general guideline, we want to eat at least 6 portions of organically grown fruits and vegetables every day. Definitely juice organically fresh foods. If you have the type of lifestyle which you're unwilling to change, I think it's unfortunate, but at the very least, there are dehydrated fruit and vegetable powders which can be consumed, which do make up for the difference. Gary, I love your brands of Red Stuff and Green Stuff. These are very highly concentrated, alive substitutes for those who, you know, can only do what they're willing to do. I like to add those in my juices already to go a little bit over the top there. And another very important thing is probably to eat a certain amount of farm-raised fish. You know, ocean fish is highly polluted with more chemicals than we have time to go into now. But, you know, fish like salmon, tuna, swordfish, mackerel, they're very rich sources of what are known as fatty acids. Omega-3 fatty acids in particular are a type that has a beneficial effect upon cardiovascular health, regardless of the conditions we're speaking about. So that's a very important source. Or for those of you who don't eat animal products such as fish, flaxseed oil is a very important source of omega-3s and also what are called omega-6 and omega-9 oils, which we need to improve the quality of our blood and also control inflammation. You know, cardiovascular disease, many of you may not know, is actually could be called an inflammatory disease. Inflammation in blood vessels degenerates blood vessels. And this is this inflammation where the body mounts an antioxidant attack. So the body produces cholesterol, which has antioxidant properties against this inflammation in the blood vessel, but then you deposit cholesterol and that can become a problem. So why is there inflammation in the blood vessel? Well, we're going to talk about that in a few minutes. The other thing, of course, would be to really watch one's alcohol consumption. I personally recommend no alcohol consumption, but some sources, some studies seem to suggest that alcohol may reduce the risk of ischemic stroke, but may actually increase the risk, Gary, of hemorrhagic stroke. So, I mean, I think that on occasion, in the context with a healthy food plan, which also includes exercise, stress reduction, and the addition of some of these nutrients we're talking about, I can't believe that occasional alcohol consumption really would be a major factor. But, of course, if someone's at the end stage or at a stage of coronary artery disease where we really want to reduce all these stressors and question marks, I would not have them consume alcohol. So let us speak about Well, about some nutrients. Let's talk about actual doses of specific types of supplements. And I'll be speaking about some vitamins, minerals, and also herbs, very, very important, and some other nutritional factors. Acetyl L-carnitine. Most people know carnitine, but there's a particular form of carnitine called acetyl L, A-C-E-T-Y-L. And this form of carnitine is much more available, much more utilizable in the body. And it's been shown to help the body use those essential fatty acids, which are definitely important for the heart health. And generally, for cardiovascular prevention, probably 500 milligrams a day is fine. But if you've got any suggestion of real cardiovascular disease, 1 to 3 grams or 1 to 3,000 milligrams in divided doses, 2 or 3 doses throughout the day, would be very important. Another very important nutrient, Gary, is coenzyme Q10, commonly known as COQ10 or ubiquinone. And it's called ubiquinone because it's ubiquitous. It's found in every cell in the body, particularly tissues with very high metabolic rates, like the heart. So the amount for prevention, in my opinion, should be at least 30 milligrams, but I like to consume about 100 milligrams of coenzyme Q10. What's really interesting, Gary, is one of the major drugs now, these statin drugs used for lowering cholesterol, includes Lipitor. And Lipitor is a coenzyme Q10 antagonist. In other words, it will lower coenzyme Q10 levels in the body. And this information is in what's called a physician's desk reference. So really, every physician must legally inform patients of these problems with the medications so that they might supplement for these very important things. So here we are taking a drug for lowering cholesterol, which might in fact lower cholesterol, but it doesn't reduce heart disease risk. And those are two very different things. Maybe one of the reasons is because it reduces coenzyme Q10 to extremely small levels in the body. Another very important thing is vitamin E. And in terms of vitamin E, I like the natural forms definitely. Synthetic forms I do not recommend. The natural forms have the natural alpha, delta, and gamma tocopherols, okay? And I particularly like brands that have at least 400 milligrams of the alpha tocopherol form and some other amount of the deltas and the gammas. Kind of like a 1-to-1 ratio of those. But very, very important. At least 400 milligrams, maybe as much as 800 international units, 800 IUs, okay, or 400 IUs. Now, for those of you who already have existing cardiovascular disease and you might be on blood thinners, you do want to let your doctors know about your vitamin E use, because it could increase the effectiveness of the anticoagulants they give you, or vitamin E is a natural anticoagulant, so you may be able to reduce the drugs you're on or eliminate them completely, but you might cause problems if you're experimenting on your own, depending on who you are. So you should probably let your nutritionally oriented healthcare provider know about that. The same is true with ginkgo biloba. Ginkgo is a very effective blood thinner, and it helps prevent, in other words, it helps prevent abnormal clumping of cells known as platelets, which are needed for blood clotting. So it's important, if you're taking vitamin E and ginkgo and you're on any other medications, you would want to have that reviewed. Now, I want to speak about three other nutrients that are very important related to a chemical called homocysteine. So this is now a conversation about assessment, but also nutritional supplementation. So for those of you who don't know what homocysteine is, basically it's a toxic amino acid. And we have known about the role of homocysteine in cardiovascular disease and about 50 other human diseases, without any exaggeration, for over 30 years. And this information is only recently breaking through in mainstream. It was a New York Times article about 8 or 10 months ago, which was front page of the Science Times, which said, oh, guess what? Cholesterol, body, blood fats, these are not nearly as important as predictors of who's going to get and die of heart disease than this amino acid known as homocysteine. Basically, you don't want it in your bloodstream. It causes inflammatory degenerative changes wherever it goes. It's been linked to Alzheimer's disease. It's been linked to osteoporosis. It's been linked to cancer, heart disease, and a variety of other conditions, as I've said. Now, what's interesting about homocysteine is it's easily measurable, Any doctor's office can measure it in what's called a red top tube. Most insurance companies cover it, and you can lower it. You can fix it. Now, many people I have noticed are on truckloads of vitamins and nutrients for a long time, and we check them, and their homocysteine is still high. So sometimes there are absorbability problems, but they can be overcome. But homocysteine is genetically controlled in part, meaning that it's a marker of how well your body genetically is able to use at least these three vitamins, but probably others, folic acid, B12, and B6, and it's thought in that order. In other words, if someone has a high homocysteine, probably they need more folic acid. But common sense tells us in natural medicine, we never give one nutrient. We always give all of the other synergistic nutrients as if nature intended it that way. So the New York Times article incorrectly pointed out my opinion, oh, simply take folic acid and you do it. Well, many people have done that and it hasn't worked. So you need a certain amount of B12. So the amount of folic acid probably that one needs, and I want to, of course, preface this by saying that a person needs whatever they need to lower the homocysteine. And when you do lower that homocysteine, you really have done something for prevention. You know, oftentimes, again, we feel fine and we do things, and we still have that uncertainty. Have we done anything? So sometimes looking at these objective markers, for me personally, really gives me a sense of, wow, I have that certainty that what I'm doing every day, it makes it easier for me to take those nutrients every day, to juice every day, to exercise, reduce my stress, because I know I can actually affect something. So no less than 400 micrograms of folic acid, but I probably would take double that. No less than 1,000 micrograms of B12. And some people require shots of these nutrients, but of course you can try this orally and through foods as well. And in terms of the type and form of B6, I like to use the active form of B6 called pyridoxal 5-phosphate. And at least 50 to 100 milligrams of that. Now, those nutrients would generally be contained in a potent multivitamin, and you certainly want to give that a try. I would have you have your blood homocysteine checked. And another interesting thing is, and a lot of doctors give people a little heartache about checking this thing, because they'll say, well, listen, your blood cholesterol is fine, and your triglycerides are fine, and your good cholesterol called the HDL is fine, and your bad cholesterol called the LDL is okay. Well, that's very nice, except most people with heart disease and stroke have normal blood fats anyway. They don't tend to have normal homocysteine, though. So it's important to check that homocysteine. So, again, folic acid, B12, B6. Magnesium, extremely important. If someone came into our office with a hypertensive episode really bad, we might refer them to the emergency room. Half the time when they got there, the hospital would give them intravenous magnesium because they know it will lower the blood pressure. They simply forget to tell people to continue to take magnesium when they leave. They leave them with a handful of medications to lower it, which are everything but magnesium. Now, I don't mean to oversimplify, but magnesium is rich in the heart. It causes healthy function of blood vessels, and it will lower blood pressure as long as you get to the dose that you need. It's very effective intravenously, but it, of course, is effective orally as well. A person may have to take a lot of it, though, so sometimes depending on the state, again, of the one's cardiovascular problems, they may need to take it in intravenous form, or they might want to take an oral form of magnesium citrate malate, anywhere from 800 milligrams to about 1,000. It should be slightly more magnesium than calcium. And isn't it interesting that magnesium requires B6, and B6 requires B12, and B12 requires folic acid, so we can see how all these things are related. So these nutrients are to be taken in context with all of these healthy diet things that I mentioned. In addition, alpha-lipoic acid is quite important as well. We have found that this B vitamin derivative not only is important for liver detoxification, but it helps nerve health. And the heart and blood vessels have a nerve supply. If someone has a stressed-out lifestyle, their nervous system is turned on too much, and that causes violent contractions and abnormal rhythms and rates of the heart. Lipoic acid helps to balance that out, as does magnesium, as does potassium, and everything else we've talked about. Probably vitamin C, extremely important. Vitamin C, as many of you know, is an antioxidant. But vitamin C is also needed to build up collagen, which is a type of tissue in the body. Blood vessels are made partly of collagen. Degenerative changes in blood vessels require more vitamin C for repair. So there's oxidative damage in blood vessels, so we want an antioxidant like vitamin C. Very effective form and way of supplementing with vitamin C I like is Gary's buffered powdered vitamin C.
No, it's never good to mention something that would be self-serving to me. So please don't mention any brand names. That wouldn't be fair. Okay?
So, yes. So we'll want, let me take that back. What we want is a buffered vitamin C powder. Okay? And you want to make sure it is buffered. You don't want it ascorbic acid. You want it buffered so it's easy to tolerate. And one can figure out how much vitamin C they need pretty accurately by doing a little test. What you do is you take a teaspoon of vitamin C powder, the buffered C powder, in about a half a glass of water or dilute juice that you're not allergic to, and you do that every 30 minutes. And you do that until you have a loose stool or diarrhea. Now, obviously, you don't want that much vitamin C, but you want to saturate your cells, and you want to keep them saturated with vitamin C. No more and no less. So the amount of vitamin C one needs is 75% of the amount that it took for you to reach this bowel tolerance or this loose stool. So it's under that. And whatever that amount is, if it took you 10 teaspoons to do that, you need 75% of that, so roughly 7 teaspoons or something like that. Take it in roughly 3 divided doses. That's ideal. Or if you really don't want to go through that, certainly taking at least anywhere from 2 to 5,000 milligrams of vitamin C in a capsule form is probably fine. And vitamin C now, of course, comes with other synergists like bioflavonoids and things of that nature, which increase the effectiveness of the vitamin C. Let me speak about some of the ways, again, that, you know, one would check or suspect that they may have cardiovascular problems, or they want to make sure they're avoiding them, again, because it is the number one killer in the United States. So you have some education about that. One, of course, everyone knows. It's the blood fats. It's looking at cholesterol and HDLs, considered the good fats, and LDLs, considered the bad fats, and triglycerides. But again, as I said, most people with heart disease and stroke have normal blood fats. That's not to say that there isn't some value in using these fats as a marker. So we have to realize that the body makes most of the cholesterol, actually makes all of the cholesterol that it needs, predominantly in the liver, but every cell membrane actually does make cholesterol. So people are under the mistaken impression that it's always their diet. You know, I don't understand it. They'll say I've reduced my cholesterol in my diet, or I'm a vegan, what have you. Why would I have high cholesterol? Now, first of all, it's quite rare for a vegan to have high cholesterol, but it is possible. But the average person can't quite understand, because maybe for the last 3 months they've reduced their fats. The bottom line is this. Even if you have a low cholesterol diet, which is certainly probably preferable, definitely preferable, your body, if the liver is under stress and there's a lot of oxidative stress in the body, it will produce more cholesterol as an antioxidant for repair. The body is trying to do the right thing, but if it's continually faced with other stressors, like a poor diet, like chronic stress, you know, when we're under chronic stress, our cortisol levels go up, our DHE levels go down, our insulin gets all screwy, we put on fat, and we increase inflammation in the body. I mean, that's somewhat overly simplistic, but it is true, and it is proven to be so. So in terms of cholesterol, we don't just want to focus on nutrition or drugs just to push down cholesterol. Now, if cholesterol and blood fats, or some of the blood fats, are high, and someone's got a high homocysteine, which, by the way, most labs consider anything above a 9 as abnormal, if someone has a high homocysteine, that's going to cause degenerative changes, as I've said. The body's probably increasing cholesterol and the other fats to repair it. So the best method probably is to lower homocysteine first with the B6, the B12, the folic acid. And when that's, from our observations, Guy, we've noticed homocysteine will come down. And once you keep it down for a while, then the body tends to lower the cholesterol. At first, it doesn't drop down right away usually until homocysteine's been normalized for a little bit of time, sometimes several weeks. And that makes sense. If the bad guy's gone, now we can really do a thorough cleanup and not have to also deal with the bad guy. And then once the bad guy's gone, homocysteine, then we can effect repair, and then the cholesterol and the other blood fats come down. So homocysteine is very simple. Another thing one could do is just check serum levels of B12. I mean, it is incomplete, but sometimes low levels of serum B12, they're also correlated with an increased risk of heart disease. Now, I want to draw a distinction here. Your doctor might say, well, why do homocysteine? I measured your serum B12, and I measured your serum folic acid. And besides the fact that these tests are not particularly accurate, even if they were, that only tells us that someone may have enough of those nutrients. But homocysteine tells us if our body is utilizing the nutrients together well. So in other words, homocysteine is a functional assessment of how well someone uses B12, B6, and folic acid. And also, homocysteine is dependent, and this is not commonly known, also on vitamin E, B1, and vitamin C. So very important. Another very useful measure in the blood, which is a functional nutritional marker of coronary artery disease, or one's predilection for it, is what's called methylmalonic acid. Methylmalonic acid is a marker of how well the body utilizes B12 predominantly and folic acid. Homocysteine is a little more accurate for folic acid and then B12, so they're kind of reversed. We like measuring them both at the same time so we don't miss anything. If we normalize those, we feel really confident that we've made a difference. And of course, as you're doing that, people are feeling better that have obvious symptoms. You know, because again, if we don't have symptoms of these problems sometimes, you need to rely on these sort of markers, or you could rely on these sort of markers to really, really make a difference that way. Another marker which could be measured on the blood is what's called C-reactive protein, or what's called CRP. Now, every cardiologist knows about CRP and homocysteine and methylmalonic acid, but again, it's almost like twisting their arms to do it. Your average practitioner might have vaguely heard these terms, so it really is up to us to be proactive and insist. Don't merely ask to have these done. Insist on getting them done. But CRP is a simple blood test, again, commonly covered under insurance. Like homocysteine, it's an inflammatory marker. And it's not exclusive to cardiovascular disease. Autoimmune disease, cancer, osteoporosis commonly have high levels of homocysteine and CRP. Now, if you do get CRP tested, there are two types. There's regular CRP. And then there's what's called a high-sensitivity CRP. High sensitivity is quite specific for cardiovascular disease. The other regular CRP is for general inflammation, so it certainly has a value. But if you want to really hone in on cardiovascular tendencies, you check the high-sensitivity CRP. The doctor has to write that down on the form. If they just put CRP, they'll get you the wrong test. You can miss the boat completely. Now, why know about CRP and why know about homocysteine? Well, if they're inflammatory, if they're oxidizing, we want to think about the antioxidants. We want to think about juicing. We want to think about vitamin E. We want to think about vitamin C, coenzyme Q10. Even magnesium is an antioxidant. Beta-carotene, there are a multitude of things which can lower these. And if they're both high, you'd want to lower both of them. So again, we don't miss anything. And then you know you can gauge your doses against what works for your body. And just to quickly mention some other things that might be of importance for some people that are really concerned, and let's say the homocysteine and the CRPs are fine, but again, you've got a really strong family history of it, you want to know about genetics a little bit more, it's what's known as lipoprotein A, which can be done as well, and something called fibrinogen. And I also favor practitioners who look at blood microscopically as well, because, you know, someone could have beautiful-looking blood, and let's say a normal number of platelets. Platelets, as we said earlier, are cells that have to do with blood clotting. We don't want them to work ineffectively, either too much or too little. If you look at platelets under a microscope, you can know if they're abnormally clumping or not. If you simply measure them on blood, you just know if there's a normal number of them. But that could be an artificial number, because if you have 10 platelets clumped together, the automated machine which counts up platelets counts them as one. So it's important, I think, to look both at a qualitative view of someone's blood, and I just gave one example of what a microscopic procedure can do, and regular blood as well. Let's speak a little bit about some other treatments. Now, again, from a medical point of view, we know there's coronary bypass. We know there are medications like Lipitor, what are called statin drugs. And not too long ago, Gary, on a very well-known show on television, They literally were trying to push cholesterol-lowering drugs as preventative medicine. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. You know, someone who I really respected previously was doing this spot and had his cholesterol measured and his homocysteine measured, and it was all very high and not looking good. And because he took Lipitor and it simply lowered his, I'm sorry, they did not measure his homocysteine, simply because it lowered his cholesterol, he felt that that it worked. But we have to understand that there is a suggestion that these cholesterol-lowering drugs, although they may lower cholesterol and blood fats, that doesn't mean they decrease heart disease risk. That's like saying someone has arthritis in their joints and they take a steroid and to say they don't have arthritis anymore. In fact, they don't even sense it anymore, so they're moving their joints around, causing more degeneration until the steroids wear off. So we know that from a holistic perspective, it never makes sense. We do not have drug deficiencies. We have too much stress, not enough water, not enough nutrition, not enough exercise, or these sorts of things. When all else fails, yes, maybe then we look at medications. Then maybe then, yes, we might look at bypass. But as a first resort, in almost every case, it isn't even scientifically valid. You know, Gary, one of the interesting things that we commonly hear, and you hear this, of course, all the time, which is completely false, they say, well, there's no evidence for what you're talking about. You and I, our eyes reel when we hear this, because anyone with access to a computer or Medline, which is what's called the medical reference engine online, easily can find out all of these studies on their own. They're there. But we think that the average physician takes the time or has the type of practice which is about health building as opposed to just symptom suppression. So it's this catch-22 here where there's so much study, and so much clinical evidence, but it's just not promoted. And the other interesting thing, Gary, is I believe it was the New England Journal of Medicine several years ago came out with their own study that said 80% of what's done in mainstream medicine today does not have scientific double-blind placebo-controlled studies. Now, what does that mean? That means that most everything used in medicine is completely unproven. So I find that very interesting, and we hand that article out to people that tell us that their doctors say there's no evidence for what we're doing. So and I think a very integrous health provider, a holistic health provider, will always give some of these references and teach and explain this to people that come to see him or her so that they can have conversations with their other doctors. Because if we can educate them also, not that that's our primary goal in life, but if it's convenient for us to do it, we should do it. It could help many, many other people. Two other last things, Gary, which I think are three other things, which are very important for assessment and treatment. One is something called an arterial stiffness index. And everyone's talking about blockages and blockages of arteries. You know, if someone happens to have chest pain and they go to their doctor, and the doctor does an angiogram and he notices that, oh my goodness, there's blockage of the arteries, it's immediately concluded that the chest pain is from the blockage. Now, many of you might be thinking, well, what else could it be from? Well, first of all, the person had chest pain, and if we know it takes 10, 20 years, or at the least a couple of years, for those arteries to become blocked, but the person didn't have chest pain, the pain isn't simply from that necessarily. You know, the body has roads and miles and miles and miles of what's called collateral circulation. Or you might think of it as sort of sleeping circulation, where there's a blockage in one area, the body will open up other areas. So even though we may see all this blockage, the doctor will commonly say, I can't believe you're walking around. Well, if they remembered their anatomy, they'd realize that there's collateral circulation and the body has ways of compensating. The point I'm trying to bring up here is that blockage is one thing, and that definitely does have some importance, but the hardness of arteries is not something that is commonly assessed. So someone may have zero blockage, but they may have too much arterial sclerosis, which causes cracking, bleeding, inflammation of these blood vessels, and pieces fall off and they float around. It's bad news. There's a very non-invasive test which uses what essentially is a modified blood pressure cuff, which sends a sound wave through it, and it actually can bounce back and give you an estimate of how hard or stiff or how much elasticity has been lost from the artery. And then when you use things like your vitamin E and your vitamin C or chelation therapy, you can prove that you actually have reduced hardening of the arteries. You've literally reversed the age of the arteries. And a recent study came out of 20 individuals where they measured their arterial stiffness against chelation therapy, which, for those of you who don't know, is an intravenous drip of an amino acid which has antioxidant properties but also chelates or removes hard particles like calcium, which harden blood vessels. And we know this is a major mechanism of heart disease, is the deposition or deposit of calcium in places it should not be. And chelation helped every single person but one in that study, which I find remarkable, with no side effects at all. So there's this arterial stiffness test that's available by some practitioners where you can gauge things. Another very interesting point in terms of hypertension, very, very important. Most of us have been led to believe that lowering of blood pressure with hypertension drugs decreases the risk of heart disease. A recent study in the Journal of Emergency Medicine in November proved that is not true. In fact, these large studies on hypertension called the Framingham studies were done on thousands of people, not just a couple, but thousands. When they looked back on these people, they noticed, yes, it's true. The hypertension-lowering medication did, in fact, lower diastolic blood pressure, which is the bottom number. We know there's like 120 over 80, which is considered the average blood pressure. There's a systolic on the top and a diastolic on the bottom. It did, in fact, these drugs lower diastolic. But when they followed these people, they found out that, guess what? We have increased their risk of coronary artery disease, heart disease from all causes. Now, why is that? Well, they looked back and they made an observation based on the old studies. These cholesterol-lowering medications, what they did was they widened the difference between the top and bottom number. They made the difference between them wider. So you can do that if you lower one number, you'll widen the difference. The difference between these two numbers is known as pulse pressure. A widened pulse pressure is associated with hardening of the arteries and heart disease. So usually when a test is done for arterial stiffness, they also measure this pulse pressure. Now, the strangest thing about this, Gary, which won't surprise you at all, is that the life insurance companies have known about this for at least 10 years. They will not insure people that have low blood pressure if they have very wide pulse pressures, because they know that these people are dropping dead of heart disease much sooner. So, and if all this sounds unbelievable and remarkable, there it was in the Journal of Emergency Medicine this November of the year 2000. So everyone's talking about it, but still, no one's measuring it, which is terrible. So we can easily modify these things, these factors, with people using natural methods. One other thing, known as a heart rate variability test. Again, non-invasive test. There's a strap that's put around one's chest. It's a very sensitive test. It measures the function of what's known as our autonomic nervous system. You can think of the autonomic nervous system sort of like the automatic nervous system. It does things without us thinking about it. It's made of two parts. The sympathetic nervous system, which you can think of as putting your foot on the gas. It's the revving up, go part of the nervous system. And then the parasympathetic part of that nervous system, which is, again, taking your foot off the gas. Now, with many types of heart disease, almost all, there's an imbalance of the autonomic nervous system. If you can think of a blood vessel, sort of like you'd think of a stick that has maybe vines that have grown around it. The vines would be the nerves that are around the stick, which is the blood vessel. The nervous system signals to that blood vessel will change the size of that blood vessel. And if someone needs more blood supply, we want that blood vessel to widen. We want more blood to go through it. The bottom line is, if the sympathetic nervous system is too active, then we don't have enough blood supply. The heart is irregular in its beat. It's on the fast side. Blood pressure tends to go up. We have these sorts of, it's associated with more heart disease. We want a balance between the two. So there's a very safe way of checking that, as opposed to, let's say, a stress test. You know, there have been studies, Gary, that demonstrate that a stress cardiogram, which many of you know of, you run around for a certain period of time as they monitor you, and sometimes they give you drugs and dyes as well, that actually has been suggested that the doing of that test actually causes more heart disease than it might prevent. So let's say that the test isn't, it can be done far less. This autonomic nervous system test, The stress of this test is someone is lying down during one half of the test and they're asked to stand up for the second part of the test. It's that sensitive to pick up the difference, because when one is lying down, it's the parasympathetic nervous system, the relaxation part, that's controlling a lot of cardiovascular or heart function. When one stands up, the sympathetic kicks in, so you can measure the difference between the two over a certain number of heartbeats. And it's important because certain nutrients support better the sympathetic nervous system or the parasympathetic nervous system. So that's kind of interesting. I want to mention one last recent thing, and this really is the last thing. There was a study recently that showed that calcification in breast tissue is in women, and probably in men, is associated with higher heart disease risk. How do you figure that, many of you might ask? Well, we know that calcium can deposit in blood vessels, making them hard, and it's reasonable now to know that's hardening of the arteries. That's bad news. And we also know that there are special MRIs that look for calcium in blood vessels in the heart. So these are just all examples of how abnormal calcium metabolism can increase heart disease risk, and probably all sorts of other things as well. So for women with calcified breast tissue, you may want to look into some of the other markers of your heart disease risk. And of course, increasing more magnesium, which helps lower the calcium and helps displace it from these areas, is very, very important. And many of the other nutrients that we mentioned. And of course, I think chelation.
Might want to mention that I'm going to be doing a special report on chelation therapy, because a Canadian review of chelation is now challenging that it had any efficacy. Well, I managed to get my hands on their preliminary report. By the way, they brought this out 3 months before it was to even be published in a peer-reviewed journal, which is not good science. Good science is that you first do a peer review, you give the people who would be supporting chelation, the scientists, a chance to review your methodology and criteria, and that was not done. But from what I understand, it's a grossly flawed, from at least what I saw, grossly flawed study. And where a lot of people will read in the newspaper, oh, chelation shows no benefit, and then they'll think, well, there's no reason I should even consider it. They're not looking at the fact it was a flawed study, just like the vitamin C study done by Dr. Morrell at Mayo Clinic was a flawed study. And they didn't give Linus Pauling a chance to give his input on it. We're coming up to the end of this program. You've given us a lot of good information, and that's why I just wanted to keep quiet, listen to you, go over your information. And if people want more information, how can they get it?
Gary, I have about 21 pages of notes on all this stuff, which they can get by calling 914-241-7030.
Thanks a lot, Michael. That's Michael, Dr. Michael Wald, W-A-L-D. Well, we're coming up to the end of another program. I hope you've enjoyed it. And for those of you who are in the greater New York City area, mind you, this program is heard all over the United States, my new Sunday evening program is heard on WNEW-FM. That's WNEW-FM, 102.7 FM. Sunday evenings from 8 to 10 p.m. That's WNEW 102.7 FM, 8 to 10 Sunday evenings. And everyone in the audience, if you have an issue that you would like to see me address on the air, please write it in care of GaryNoll.com. Put out whatever the issue is, and I'll certainly take a look at it. I want you all to have a very nice day. I'll look forward to talking with you again on our next program.